Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:02 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time on a particularly warm day in Los Angeles. And today is, of course, Friday. It's the big picture, long-term audio and video. Today is October 21st. Now, we are only just a tad more than 2 weeks away from the US election. So I think this is the very definition of silly season, and we can anticipate that, perhaps a better way to think about it is the stock market is a discounting mechanism, and what the stock market would appear to be discounting is a victory by Hillary Clinton. That would certainly appear to be the case at the very least. Now, I've got the Dow Jones up here, and it's just a daily chart, but what are we presented with? The index has been underperforming the Nasdaq, but it has continued to hold at the in the region of the upper side of its trading range overall. When we look at that on a medium-term basis, then that 18,000 level is right in the region of the 200-day moving average and the upper side of the underlying range, and that range that is underlying has persisted for a year and a half, and this is about where, if the index is going to find support, then it should be doing it around now. The performance of the Nasdaq, on the other hand, is a bit different, because what we're presented with there is really quite marked outperformance. The index had been ranging in the region of the upper side of the underlying range, but then broke out to new highs and has more or less held that advance since. So there is, if we were to just look at the relative, then there is quite marked outperformance by the Nasdaq 100. One of the things that perhaps is affecting the Dow Jones is the dollar. The dollar index, and it's something that we've been talking about pretty persistently over the last number of audios and certainly over the last few weeks, but there was a triangular pattern had evolved. You had this progression of lower rally highs and this progression of higher reaction lows, and the trading was converging. And you know, generally speaking, what happens when people see that kind of activity? Well, it's a war is going on between supply and demand, and the various fronts of that battle are getting closer and closer together. Well, when people anticipate that they're in a region where a break may occur, then they tighten their stops. It creates a vacuum of supply above the market, a vacuum of demand below. In whichever way that the price breaks, then it hits a vacuum or a pocket, and it will keep going until it encounters some resistance. And the first area of potential resistance for the dollar index is the big round 100 level. Now, of course, it is Dow Jones-type companies, well-established, globally-oriented businesses that have significant dollar income, but also have significant income in other currencies, are going to feel the brunt of that. The Nasdaq 100 obviously is stacked with the kinds of companies that share those characteristics, particularly in the technology sector. But perhaps the biggest difference is that they don't have the same degree of competition. When you look at, for example, Microsoft, it really doesn't matter what currency somebody is buying their products in. If you want an operating system and you want to have an office and a word processing system, well, then the default is going to be Microsoft. It's relatively price insensitive, at least in currency terms. One might say the same thing for Facebook, or the same thing indeed for Amazon. So that perhaps helps to explain the Nasdaq's relative performance. But the dollar index advancing in this manner has shaken up the status quo, because it has been a particularly quiet period for much of the last 5 months in the currency markets, and now we are moving out of a quiet period and into a more volatile period overall, because this doesn't look like an awful lot. It doesn't look like a particularly big move on a weekly chart. And yet, if we look at a number of other currencies, we get a somewhat different picture. So, for example, if we look at the Canadian dollar, then we can see that, in fact, the dollar has held a progression of higher reaction lows since May. And it hasn't quite updated yet, but it is going to, when that updates, it will be at a new recovery high. So, in fact, it is the dollar breaking upwards against the Canadian dollar. When we look at the Asian dollar index, then obviously that is still very heavily weighted by the renminbi, and the renminbi has been weak. In fact, the dollar's trend against it is one of the most consistent trends of any currency market. But what we're seeing on this index is that it has now broken to a new low, and it is a new closing low, and it has encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. That overall, while there is a loss of momentum, there is still a progression of lower rally highs. So if we take a bigger step back and look at this over 10 years, then certainly we have had a loss of momentum, but you would need some additional evidence of firming to really suggest that this is base formation development, and much less or even close to base formation completion. And this is a very different environment overall, because in the decade from 2003 until 2000, and I guess not quite a decade, 2010, the outlook for emerging market currencies was rather benign overall. But it's probably more accurate to say that the dollar had been trending lower, that it was very much in the interests of the US economy to have a weaker currency. And that is no longer the case on a relative basis. The US does not need to have the weakest currency in the world any longer. That mantle has probably now resides with the UK and with Europe overall, and perhaps with Japan. And because these are very large reserve type currencies, then that has also contributed to dollar strength overall. And of course, it is you can never talk about a currency in isolation. It's always a relative consideration as to if you are going to buy one currency, you are necessarily selling another one. So, what this dollar index tells us, Asian dollar index tells us, is that the dollar is getting stronger, and it is getting stronger not just against European or developed market currencies, but against a large basket of currencies as well. And that suggests that we're probably headed for some additional volatility in a number of these emerging markets. And I think when we look at, for example, the Korean won, then it's perhaps not overly surprising that the won is beginning to weaken once more when you have such stress coming into one of its largest manufacturing companies. Then when we look at, for example, the Taiwan dollar, then these are not looking like particularly strong currencies in here, that the strengthening that we've seen for much of this year would appear to be over, and we could be moving into a more volatile environment overall. So then, if that is indeed the case, it is probably really a good time to be just keeping a relatively close eye on the performance of some of these markets, because with the currency having done well, most of these indices have done pretty well this year. And when we look at, for example, the KOSPI index, then I think we've had emails to the effect that people are really starting to look at it, that and particularly when you look at it on a 10-year basis, that there is evidence that we have this very lengthy range overall. But is it going to be able to sustain a move up in an environment where the currency goes down? This isn't the same kind of environment that we have in Europe or Japan, where the outperformance of their domestic asset prices is inherently tied to the relative weakness of their currencies because they are combating deflationary pressures overall. And they are just crying out for inflation. You just don't have the same argument in places like Taiwan or Korea or Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, or India. What they have is a growth-oriented economy overall, and but also additional volatility and greater reliance on the markets that they rely on to export all of the goods that they produce. And therefore, what they need are stronger currencies, or at least firmer currencies overall. So I think we have had a very benign environment so far this year for some of these Asian markets, and if the dollar continues to rally, then they are going to come under pressure. And how much pressure they come under is likely to be quite heavily influenced by the performance of Wall Street. So the Wall Street leash effect, which really we haven't heard much about or very much talk about for really much of the last few years, I think is going to become much more of an influence if the dollar is rallying. Because if the dollar is rallying because of weakness everywhere else rather than inherent strength, then that's not particularly good news for emerging markets. If, on the other hand, the US is really maintaining its economic preeminence and consumer demand is picking up, then that should be good news for those emerging markets, and they could gain additional competitiveness by having somewhat weaker currencies. So I think that this is really very interesting time to be watching these because the consistency of the trends and the fact that they are sort of in the right in the region of their respective 200-day moving averages, and that is the case for a number of the emerging markets. It's exactly the same story for a number of the European markets, and it's exactly the same story for Wall Street. So we have, and I think that is a really great example of the fact that we have ha Before the credit crisis, we had synchronized global economic expansion. After the credit crisis, we have had synchronized monetary expansion. And we still have that with the notable absence of the USA. We still have synchronized global monetary expansion in Europe, in the UK, in Japan, and in China. So that's still a lot of money, a lot of liquidity hitting these markets, and that liquidity is global and it's mobile. So it is moving into the types of assets that have the greatest potential for additional upside. Now, we don't yet have a dollar index that has broken out. And it is perhaps worth just really taking a look at the euro, because that's not it. Excuse me. Taking a look at the euro because it is trading through 105, and sorry, trading through 110, and it does look like that 105 is not beyond the bounds of possibility. When we look at that over a 20-year basis, then we know that it traded below parity. During a time of uncertainty, very shortly after the introduction of the euro, and this range overall also had a triangular pattern. It has now broken it and has broken the progression of high reaction lows evidenced since last December, and that opens up the potential that we are going to see the 105 area at least tested. Now, there is the very large question then whether 105 is going to hold. We are entering a particularly uncertain period in terms of Eurozone politics. There is going to be a referendum in Italy. Renzi said he was going to leave office if it didn't pass when he thought it would pass. Since he is now uncertain as to whether it's going to pass, he has reneged on that commitment. The last thing the overlords in Brussels or Frankfurt want is an Italian election, having seen a referendum to reform the Senate defeated. What we've also seen is that a number of the Italian banks are trying to get their funding and debt for equity swaps done ahead of the referendum because they're wary. I guess wary is a very conservative term. They're scared that they're not going to be able to get that funding in place before the referendum. And they are afraid of the uncertainty that that could unleash. But as if it wasn't a big enough problem that you have a referendum in Italy, you also have a German election coming up next year, a French election coming up next year. In fact, in today's copy, I've listed them. So, you know, there are a significant number of elections coming up this next year. There's Germany, France, the Netherlands, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Slovenia. There is the Italian referendum, and as if all of that weren't enough, then there is going to be the beginning of the negotiations with the UK on what its relationship is likely to be when it leaves. So that represents really quite profound uncertainty. It's rather hard to imagine that the euro is going to be going up in that environment. And then realistically, while it hasn't yet broken below 105, then we simply could not rule out the possibility that it is going to break below 105 and potentially go right down and test parity. And I think that that is important, because if we really look at what is the asset class that has done least over the last year, then European equities have been pretty moribund for the last year and a half. And that is the Euro Stoxx index. It's the broad Euro Stoxx index over the last 16 years. And it has been ranging in an incredibly volatile manner. That 300 level represents the upper side of the base that, and it was a very volatile base, but it is a base between 2008 and 2013. And this has been a very volatile environment overall. If indeed the euro does trade down to 105 and below it, well then that is going to represent a shot in the arm for the competitiveness of the eurozone. It is going to represent an important catalyst to drive nominal asset prices higher. And of course, that is as true of the bond markets as it is of the stock markets and the property markets. So, and we know what happened last time. This run-up at the beginning of 2015 was occurred with the devaluation of the euro, that you had a big run-up in nominal prices. In currency-adjusted prices, the index didn't really go anywhere. But in nominal prices, it went up a lot. And this looks like a bullish consolidation above 320. And a breakout to new recovery highs would reassert demand dominance overall. So I think that we haven't had as an attractive a period of time to be starting to think about European equities in nominal terms for really quite some time. The DAX index has been leading, there are very good reasons for that. Germany is still the preeminent economy. It has benefited most from the relative weakness of the euro in terms of its competitiveness, because it has such a large export market outside of the eurozone. And I think that is one of the primary issues for a number of the peripheral countries like Italy or Spain. And it is that their export markets outside the euro are not as large as Germany's. So one of the things that is hampering the European recovery is that with the introduction of the euro, that was a green light for just about all eurozone corporations to expand within the Eurozone. And for a decade, they kind of neglected their expansion internationally, and that is now coming back to bite them. But when we look at that German index, and of course it is a total return index, so it is not a nominal price index like we see with most of the other European indices, but it does look like this is a bullish consolidation. It has broken the progression of lower rally highs. It has found support in the region of the 200-day moving average. And if we do see additional euro weakness, then I think it is quite likely that we're going to see this thing breaking up and running. If most of these European indices are doing that, then what about the FTSE? The FTSE 100 is in many respects like the Dow Jones. It has a significant number of very large internationally oriented companies, and it has benefited enormously since July due to the weakness of the pound. And you know, in many respects, I think you know we could say that the UK has got first mover advantage, that it did exactly the same thing in 2008. The pound declined in a dynamic fashion in 2008, and we had a very, very swift depreciation of the currency, and that resulted in a competitive advantage overall for the UK economy. Well, the pound has fallen from 170 to 120 in the last 2 years, and that is a significant depreciation, and there is no evidence that it has ended. This is still a reasonably consistent downtrend. The steadying that we have had so far has been relatively modest. There does not appear to be a rush of new buyers coming into the market, and we could have another step, and we can see that these steps have lasted in the region of 2 to 3 months before we get an additional decline. The UK has made absolutely no secret of the fact that they need a weaker currency and that they are going to do whatever is required to achieve a weaker currency, and perhaps most particularly against the euro. So if the euro is falling, then that will put additional pressure on the pound to continue falling in order to preserve the UK's competitive advantage relative to its continental neighbors. If that is indeed the case, then that should act as a bullish catalyst overall. And I think at the beginning in nominal terms and medium term in more concrete terms, but that wouldn't really be realized by the stock market until there is at least some evidence that the currency has stopped going down. And you know, if we look at, for example, the mid caps, then you're presented with a more consistent environment overall. These are primarily the UK oriented companies, and I think it is also worth looking at the AIM 100, which are the small caps, because they have really been out in the wilderness for you know, the last 5 years. But the index is now pressuring the upper side of that range, and it is overbought in the short term. There is certainly the potential for some consolidation in the region of 4,000, but it is something that could do really quite well over the medium term. Now, what are the things? What we've talked about so far are some of the events that are likely to shape the future over the next year. And we know that there are problems. The issues that we have are really quite profound, because the Eurozone is in trouble. There is a rise of populism that is evident. It's not just in the UK. There is a rising populist tide in Italy, in France, and in Germany, as well as in the USA. And you know, it would be to say one thing if it was in one country, but because it is in so many countries, then we can only conclude that there is something systemic, that if we had synchronized global economic expansion, we probably wouldn't be having this talk. But because we've had synchronized global monetary expansion, we are having this talk because the people that have benefited from it has been really rather disjointed. The holders of assets have done very well, and the buyers of assets have not. And that has resulted in a failure of living standards to improve. And I think a lot of people would argue that their living standards have deteriorated despite the fact that monetary accommodation has been profound. So then we are getting this rise of populism, and I think part of the reason for that is because people have been not served particularly well by the kind of policies that have been put in place. Now, we could sit and talk about what the problems are all day, but what we should really think about are what are the potential solutions and what are the ways that that we can make money out of it. Well, if we have a rise of populism, then we could have a balkanization of trade, and that would potentially be a headwind overall for stock markets. What we could also have is a realization that rather than become increasingly protectionist, that what really needs to happen is that the technological innovation that is likely to persist regardless of what the political environment is, but it could really enhance decision making. It could really enhance the ability of people to be enfranchised. That the rapid advance of artificial intelligence in particular could be introduced into government to really add transparency to the decision-making process, to really enhance the data-driven decision-making process rather than the rather morally corrupt and yet realpolitik of lobbyists telling politicians what to do and how they should vote. That might sound Pollyanna-ish, and having said it, I think it sounds almost too good to be true, and yet it would represent a potentially very beneficial development because it would help to enfranchise people. And I think one of the problems that I think a lot of people have, and I think that technology itself is something that is contributing to this disenfranchisement, is that people do not feel that they are being listened to or that their interests are being best served both by the elitist political class or the rapid rise of automation and technology overall. Having spent a few days in Boston this week at the MIT Emerging Technology Conference, then it is very easy to become very, very excited about the pace of robotic and artificial intelligence innovation. I think what we're seeing is that smart people are getting data sets together that and learning how to train robots to do progressively more manual tasks. And that is going to require a workforce of humans that are technically savvy. So, if any of these solutions then are going to come true, then the education system, and I think most particularly adult education, has to become a lot cheaper, a lot more accessible, and a lot more effective for a lot more people if we're really going to have a productive workforce overall, because the pace of robotic innovation is really almost mind-blowing. And what we're also seeing is that and it's something that I'm very conscious of, is that what we have is an environment, particularly in Silicon Valley, that is on a promotion overdrive. That certainly there is technological innovation, but that we are getting promoters, making claims that were potentially not realizable for 5 or even 10 years, and yet they're talking about them as if they'll be available tomorrow. And autonomous vehicles is certainly one of those. There is a competition going on, and I think this is almost analogous to what you see in the latter stages of a bull market, where analysts compete with one another to say how much they think a stock is going to go up. What we are seeing is autonomous vehicle companies and CEOs competing with one another to say how wonderful their inventions are and how quickly they are going to come to market. And if we actually look at Tesla's share price, then we can just ask some very simple filter questions. And I guess the first one would be, is it trending or ranging? And it did trend, but it is definitely ranging. What could we say about that range? Is it inert or is it volatile? Well, it was very volatile and it has become less volatile. Do we see a triangular pattern overall? Well, there's certainly a progression of lower rally highs, and there is a very incremental progression of higher reaction lows. It could break either up or down, and that high in the region of 215 is the lowest rally high, and the highest reaction low is at 190. So, having moved from a spread of almost $150, we're down to a spread of about $20 in trading. And that is significantly less volatile than we've seen previously. Therefore, and not least because this is a share that is trading on an extraordinarily aggressive multiple, then the CEO has to be seen to be pushing the envelope in order to justify that multiple. They really are sailing so close to the wind that just one bad quarter could see the price come down and come down very heavily. But the performance of Tesla is unlikely to have really any influence on the ability of the sector to evolve. That it is not the only company offering electric vehicles or offering autonomous vehicles. And it is certainly a sector that is going to have a very big impact overall. When we then look at the healthcare sector, the introduction of the analysis of massive data sets and the rapidly evolving ability to take longitudinal data sets so that we're not just getting our blood pressure measured once a month or once a year, but rather that it's getting measured all the time, or that blood glucose is a real-time measurement, or oxygenation is a real-time measurement. And this is becoming progressively easier, and that we're going to see a range of wearable technology hitting the market within the next couple of years that is going to make what is on the market now look like the I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that what we have on the market now is very first generation. It's like having a Nokia or a Motorola flip phone relative to an iPhone. That is, I think, the difference in the kinds of wearable technology that are coming down the line. And that is also going to massively enhance our ability overall. I saw this presentation, and it might be a decade before ambient radio waves are commercially viable, but they do have a working prototype of a sensor that does not require a battery being implanted into a contact lens and measuring glucose levels in real time. So they also have a prototype for a neural implant. Now, if anyone has ever watched Star Trek, then the Borg and their neural implants were one of the most sort of interesting technologies explored overall, and we are already seeing that these types of devices are already being prototyped. If and of course that is simply a mechanical solution. There are genetic solutions coming through as well. I was chatting with a researcher at one of MIT's labs yesterday about how they are working with phages. That realistically, the fight against antibiotic resistance is a losing battle overall, because it doesn't matter how strong the antibiotic is, that it simply succeeds in thinning out the competition for the one strain of bacteria that is resistant to it, and then that strain has unfettered ability to replicate and multiply. So antibiotic resistance is a losing battle, and what we need are additional vectors. And I think it was certainly Russia and France were the leaders in the development of phages, which are viruses that kill bacteria. And that is certainly a rather vibrant way of tackling that particular problem. So when we take a step back, and then if we look at consumer electronics, we look at wearable technology, and we look at the increasingly rapid advances in synthetic biology, where viruses can be custom designed in very, very short periods of time to target cancer in particular, because that's a high value market, a high margin market. These are things that are going to be part of our future. So, there is certainly challenges out there, and but it the reality is that technology is improving at such a rapid rate that the potential for massive productivity growth, for the evolution of new types of work, new industries to evolve that simply did not exist previously, and for those to completely overwhelm the economy as we see it today, I think has to be the base case. Then the question is, rather, how likely is it that economies are going to be able to rise to that challenge? I think the US still has that preeminence, despite the rather shameful political campaigns that have been pursued in the run up to this election. The reality is that it still has a rather wide technological and energy competitive advantage. Europe is in a has got some serious trouble, and they're going to have to figure out how to enfranchise their people if the union is going to hold together. Japan and Europe are both experimenting with negative interest rates, and that really is a problem, because it is inherently deflationary, and the last thing they need is more deflation. I think we, despite the fact that all of this technological innovation is incredibly exciting, we cannot forget that we have been in a 35-year, in fact, it's a 36-year bull market for bonds overall, and this isn't something that's going to last forever. So, the reality is that if the US really does have a preeminent position, then it doesn't need to have interest rates so very low. And that, in fact, the healthiest thing that could happen would be for interest rates to rise and for the economy to be healthy enough to absorb them. But if interest rates rise, then that will put additional upward pressure on the dollar. And there is an awful lot of debt outstanding that is still denominated in dollars. Anyone who's even remotely smart in a corporate treasury would have negated that risk 2 years ago when the dollar began to rally. But unfortunately, that is just not the way the world works. There's still a lot of debt that is denominated in dollars. And that is going to also represent a headwind for emerging markets if the dollar continues to rally. There is the potential, that technology will advance quick enough to make the debt problems less severe. But in order for that to happen, the standards of governance in a whole number of jurisdictions are going to have to improve and improve a lot. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for today. Actually, I think I should talk a little bit about gold, because gold is perhaps the asset class that is a bet that the rest of the world is just not going to get its act together, and that we are going to have ma mass massive monetary intervention overall. When we look at that long-term chart, then we can see here that gold is still right in the region of the 200-day moving average. It has at least paused, and what it needs to do is to rally and to break that progression of lower rally highs evident over the last 4 months. If it can do that, then we're still in a medium-term bull market. But it really is right in the region where, if the demand-dominated environment is going to be reasserted, then it is going to happen in this exact area. And the other interesting market is oil. Oil prices are unlikely to get back up to $100. But this has been a reasonably steady consolidation in the region of the upper side of the range. There was a short-term overbought condition. It is being unwound. We're in a ranging environment overall. The big question is supply. It is down to OPEC and Russia whether they are going to be willing to withdraw supply from the market. And that could temporarily send prices higher. But the pace of innovation in the solar sector is really just remarkably impressive. The cost of solar cells continues to trend lower, and penetration is at about 1%. And one of the things that Ray Kurzweil talks about is the exponential growth curve. And it's 1% is where you start to see really meaningful changes in the penetration of a product in a market. When it is at 1/1000th of 1%, it can double and go to 2/1000th of 1%, but nobody cares. But that doubling takes time, and it goes from 2/1000th to 4/1000th to 8/1000th, and you can see the progression. It takes a long time to get to 1%. But then when it gets to 1% and doubles, it gets to 2%. And when it gets to 2%, it gets to 4%. And that is when you start to get real change. That's when it can really impact. An interesting statistic was from this conference was that a significant quantity of the water that the US relies on goes to cooling power plants. And of course, if there were fewer power plants using nuclear or conventional fuels, then that would allow greater quantities of water for farming and for industrial uses. So what happens in oil and what happens in the energy market is important. I think that what we're going to have with the oil market overall is a very prolonged ranging environment. That's exactly what we've seen in oil previously. We've seen that, and this is the very historic chart. It's more than a century long for oil prices, and you get very lengthy ranging phases followed by big bull markets. And we are at the lower side of a very lengthy trading range, and this trading range could persist far into the future. We could be ranging in a manner like this for 20 years. Now, I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'm going to wish all the best to all of you.